From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with author Amy Bonifons, whose debut novel is The Regrets, published by Little Brown. Here's a little information about the book. Reality and dream collide in Amy Bonifons' dazzling, darkly playful debut novel about a love affair between the living and the dead. For weeks, Rachel has been noticing the same golden-haired young man sitting at her Brooklyn bus stop, staring off with a melancholy air. When one day she finally musters the courage to introduce herself, the chemistry between them is undeniable. Thomas is wise, witty, handsome, mysterious, clearly a kindred spirit. There's just one tiny problem. He's dead. Stuck in a surreal limbo governed by bureaucracy, Thomas is unable to cross over to the afterlife until he completes a 90-day stint on Earth, during which time he is forbidden to get involved with a member of the living, lest he incur regrets. When Thomas and Rachel break this rule, they unleash a cascade of bizarre, troubling consequences. Amy Bonifon's work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Kenyon Review, among other places, and has been read on This American Life. She's a founding editor of 7x7, an online journal that publishes collaborations between writers and visual artists. She holds an MFA from NYU and currently lives in Athens, Georgia, where she's pursuing a PhD at the University of Georgia. And Amy is on the line right now, ready to speak to us. Amy, welcome to Write the Book. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Regrets is such an original novel. It's poignant, it's peculiar, and it's fun. I thought we could start by having you talk a little bit about how the book started for you.
Yeah, sure. So I think as with any project, there are multiple sources of inspiration. One of them was that I had written a short story a couple years before that. It's in my collection, The Wrong Heaven. And it's a very brief story about an encounter between a dying woman and the angel of death. And he's kind of hunky. And
right.
It's a sort of an erotic encounter between them. And I was really interested in this idea of sort of like the death as an erotic or eroticized space.
Right.
And I had this thought that perhaps I could expand on the conceit of that story, which was this, you know, when you die, this sort of sexy angel of death shows up and feeds you this black stone, which then carries you into the next world. I kept thinking, like, oh, that could be a novel. And so I tried different ways into it, and at first none of them were really working. And then sort of on a parallel track, I was trying to figure out how to write about this certain kind of romance. I'm not even sure I knew what I was trying to do at the time. I just knew I kept circling back to this certain type of relationship that I wanted to describe, in which at least one of the partners is like there, but not there.
Right.
Because they're dealing with something really intense, in their private life and trying to kind of connect to someone, you know, build a bridge to someone across across their own trauma. And so I came up with this idea of a man who literally is there and not there because he's in this limbo between life and death and he's sort of falling apart. And so bringing those two ideas together was what really allowed the novel to gel.
Yeah. Let's see. I do love when people find original ways to inform the reader and also broaden the structure of fiction at the same time. And so many of Thomas's point of view chapters begin with an italicized paragraph of tips for how to manage the 3-month period in which he has to just kind of walk around somewhere between life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one example here. Do you mind if I read something?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. This is one example. Structured activity is an excellent antidote to loose and dangerous thoughts. Enjoy the hobbies you practiced in your previous life or try something new. Try to resist the temptation to tie your current life to your previous life. Remember, strictly speaking, you do not exist. So I thought that was fun. Were these fun to write? Did they help you in any particular way as you worked?
Yeah. Yeah, they were fun to write. And I think it was helpful to have this other voice come in, the voice of that document.
Right.
Partly, as you say, just as a sort of method of exposition, right? Because it would be really boring if Thomas, the first person narrator, just explained the rules of his situation to the reader.
Right.
I wanted to have another way to present those to the reader. And it was a chance to develop a slightly different voice than his, this sort of institutional voice that definitely is, holding its cards close to the vest. It's not going to explain too much, but it's going to explain just enough to scare you.
Right.
And I think a lot of institution speak is that way, whether it's like the legalese on a contract you sign or, just the even the like in-flight demonstration of your safety belt, it's like they're giving you just enough information that they're kind of covering their butts,
yeah.
But they're not really being that helpful to you. And they're sort of gesturing at the things that could go wrong. So that was a sort of a fun voice to play with, but also a very, I think it's very, a very confining, obviously, to be stuck in this limbo that Thomas is stuck in. And so I had to also think about how that voice would land with him. So it was, it was fun to write, but it was also a little bit sad and dark to write, to think about, the constraints I was creating for this character through that voice.
And I also found it absolutely terrifying to consider death as bureaucratic. That was like,
yeah.
If there's any silver lining to the fact that we are all eventually going to die, it is that there won't be any of that, anymore.
Right. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was funny. Obviously, I hope death is not like this, but
yeah.
I thought it was funny to imagine the afterlife as sort of full of all the red tape of regular life that we're always trying to escape.
Yes.
There's this one of my inspirations was this Japanese movie called Afterlife. It came out in the 90s.
Okay.
And I've always really loved it. And so the conceit of that movie is that when you die, you go to this sort of processing center and they give you a week to choose one memory from your life, and that's the only memory you're going to take with you into eternity.
Right.
And so all these people have to choose that one memory, and they have their various ways of going about it. But at one point you learn that all the workers in this processing center are people who either refuse to choose or just couldn't choose. And so I loved this idea that the system is being run by people who sort of rejected the system or who the system failed, and that there's just this deep failure at the heart of it, and I think a lot of our real systems in life are like that. But I liked the comedy and the poignancy of the idea that, existence itself is that way somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. You're mentioning poignancy. You bring a lot of emotion and honesty to the regrets. But you never succumb to sentimentality. And I thought that was really interesting because I think that tackling subjects like love and death and bringing something a little bit different to it, it's, I think it's hard for us not to, as writers, reach for the familiar, which would possibly lead to sentimentality. So I just wondered if this was a focus for you at all and what you might say to help writers who are struggling with this issue as they tackle kind of big subjects and don't want to go for sentimentality.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. I'm glad that it doesn't read as sentimental.
No, it doesn't.
And I guess what I would say is, like, I try to kind of come at big topics like love and death and big emotions, I try to come at them sideways in some way.
Right.
And so I think all the conceptual apparatus of this book, the mechanics of the afterlife and the fact of the limbo, that's kind of one way to come at it sideways, and another way to come at things sideways is humor, I think.
Right.
To me, like, if you look at something, you can't really look at something like death head on, or you can, but not for very long. And so if you're going to write a whole novel about love and death, I think there needs to be a lot of humor and a shifting perspective, and you know, I think the conceit itself provides some distance. So yes. I guess for, you know, if I had any advice for anyone attempting a similar thing, I would just say, you know, like, find a way into it that's not direct, and that feels like something you can sustain and play with.
Right.
For a longer period of time, because the emotion at its most intense is not something you're going to be able to sustain for very long.
Yeah, that's great advice. Let's see. The narrative in The Regrets changes points of view. So you start out with Thomas, and as we've said, mm-hmm. he's the man who's dead, but not quite. And then you go into Rachel's point of view, and you change again after that. So anyway, I wonder if you can talk about changing narrative points of view and how that is for you as a writer.
Yeah, sure. So honestly, part of the reason I do that is because I have a really hard time writing in the third person. Whenever I try writing in the third person, it just like sounds dead to me. And I it's not a comment on what I like to read. I like to read, you know, all sorts of perspectives, but I just don't feel I'm very good at third person. And so, but I do think I'm good at sort of like catching a voice and running with it. So,
right.
So I thought, you know, if I'm going to tackle the project of writing a novel, I have to do it. You know, I have to play to my strengths. And so, Rachel was the first character I started writing. And then, I figured I needed to go into Thomas's point of view in order to, you know, explain the experience that he's been through. And then eventually it seemed like we needed a third character because their love grows so intense and so claustrophobic, and they become this little two-person universe. And, you know, the intensity of that two-person universe is definitely something I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But I think if that's all that the book was, it would be hard for the reader to know what to do with it. So this third character, Mark, comes in, who sort of helps to triangulate and to eventually sort of offer the characters a way out of this trap that they've gotten themselves into.
Was it a relief for you when you found Mark?
No, I think it was. I feel like I'd been writing, I knew it was pretty early, now that I think about it.
Was it?
But I didn't figure out his real purpose for a while.
Okay.
I think the voice came to me pretty early on, and then, you know, there were versions of the novel that where I took him out completely, and versions where he played a much bigger role, and took me a while to find the balance.
Yeah, we won't give away anything about the end, but it was just
right.
I was wondering as I was reading, I'm like, how's she going to bring this? What's she going to do? Anyway.
Yeah, I didn't know for a while either.
Now, for the most part, for a long time, no one notices Thomas as he wanders around killing time. But then Rachel does notice him, and she says he's hard not to notice and that he seems to glow. And you write, this man mm-hmm. always sat hunched and alone, looking both mournful and restless, his right knee bouncing up and down, staring out at the street with a last chance look as if he'd be tested on it later. And I loved that and other ways that you describe him. And I wondered if you tend to know what your characters look like as they come to you, or if you watch for them on the street, or do you look through magazines? And I'm also curious if you feel like readers need to know what characters look like.
Yeah, I'm always, you know, I'm so interested in how people visualize what they read. I do definitely need to know what a character looks like, but it's not like I need to know, like have a map of every inch of their skin. It's more like a general sort of, some general features kind of pop out at me. Like from the beginning, I knew that Rachel was going to be petite and dark haired and have these big glasses and this red lipstick.
Okay, right.
And, you know, Thomas was very clear to me. They're not necessarily based on particular people, but probably in a composite way, you know, they have features of people I've known.
Sure.
I don't think it's that important that people imagine them just the way I did. You know, I think that's what's really cool and kind of magical about having people read your work and then reflect it back to you. Sometimes they're like, you know, they would describe your own character back to you, and you're like, exactly, that's exactly how I saw it. And sometimes, like, you're like, huh, that's not how I saw it, but that's cool too, you know? I did a reading in New York last week, and there was a family friend there, and she came up to me, and she's like, I have to tell you, the whole time I was reading the book, I was picturing Thomas as this guy from a really specific Liberty Mutual commercial, and she couldn't find a link for it, but I'm going to try to find it because I'm so curious what this was. She was like, it was exactly this guy.
That's so funny.
So I'm like, you know, go for it. If it's the guy from the Liberty Mutual commercial for you, then works for me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Now let's see. I loved. Excuse me. We both have to cough. I loved your description of Rachel's work. She's a librarian at a not fancy library, and you write that elder. And this isn't a quote, but it's sort of part of your sentences where elderly people use elderly computers to check their elderly AOL accounts. That was actually a really funny paragraph, and it goes on to describe the toddlers that are there and the kids that are like poking each other and all this sort of nightmare library experiences. But I wondered, how did you decide on a job for Rachel? And, you know, I always feel like it's like I always have a hard time figuring out what my characters do for a living, because when I'm writing about them, all they do is whatever I tell them to do. And I don't know how to be a librarian, for example. So, So what do you do when you have to find a job for a character?
Yeah, it is such an interesting writerly dilemma, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I think I knew for Rachel that I wanted her to not be a writer, but be something kind of writer adjacent.
Okay.
Be somebody who once had writerly ambitions and still kind of does. And I think in many ways, like, behaves and thinks like a writer. Like, she's always observing, and she stands outside of her own life and observes it a little bit. And so librarian seems like a natural choice. And I think, even though, you know, I've never been a librarian, I spend a lot of time in libraries. I volunteered in a library for a while when I was in high school, and I feel like I understand enough about how they work that I could sort of fake it enough, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, probably there are things I get wrong, but I was drawn to, you know, particularly in that description that you just read a piece of, the way that I just imagine one might become a librarian because they love books and they're a bookworm and they're probably a kind of a solitary person, but actually libraries are such, they're these very, very public spaces, and people use them for all sorts of reasons.
Sure.
And so I liked it isn't in the book that much, but I liked the tension of, you know, this very solitary person getting dropped into, just the mess of whoever shows up at the library.
Yeah,
and I think in terms of just generally thinking of characters' jobs, I'm very lazy with doing research. I mean, I do it when I need to do it, but that's not really what motivates me as a writer. I know there's some people who are really turned on by that, so I try to give people jobs that I know enough about that I'm not going to have to do, like, tons and tons of research.
Right.
Mark has a job at the zoo, and that's actually a job that I had for a summer.
Oh, wow.
So I got to draw on all those details, and that was fun.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. It takes a while for Rachel and Thomas to meet, and and then when they do, they take this long bus ride together to the end of the line, and this sexual tension between them is, like, increasing through this entire scene, and then they make plans.
Yeah.
They make plans to meet, but they make plans to meet the next night. So there's this tension around that meeting, and you write new scenes, you know, in between the bus ride and the next night. And so I wondered if you could talk about structuring suspense in this way and what it does for the story, because I found that very suspenseful. It's like, wait a minute, you're not going to have them, like, be together for, like, another day and a half. So,
yeah, well, I'm glad that worked. I feel like, you know, like a lot of writers, I'm not a writer who works from an outline. I just very much feel my way through it. And, part of the reason is that when I've tried to write outlines, it's like then the writing becomes dead to me because I already know it's going to happen. So I'm always trying to kind of surprise myself and what might happen next. But because I'm just feeling my way through it, I've never felt like I really had a handle on what people call plot. You know, I'm like, I'm not at the dials here, you know, turning up the suspense and then creating the perfect climax that, you know, I don't know what's going on. And to the extent that that happens, it's either because I'm just doing what I need to do to sustain my own interest or because retroactively in the editing process, I figured out how to kind of retrofit that, you know? But I think the scene you're talking about, that just came out of, you know, I think when you have a crush and it's starting to heat up and you realize, oh, it's on, this is actually going to happen. There's this really delicious period of time. Sometimes it's a few days, sometimes it's longer, where you're just kind of like living for the next time you see that person. And so I just wanted to capture that and make that part of the way they get together.
And it's interesting because I was a little surprised that it was going to be like, oh, there's a delay here. But then, and actually this isn't the question I was going to ask you next, but it since it's coming up, you have the scene then that I loved so much. And it's there. She goes to a friend's house for a birthday party. She has a friend named Samira, who's this great character who has these generous impulses. Like, she is making a Moroccan meal for her friends on her own birthday, and but her ideas are always, you write, they're always hampered by basic, easily predictable facts about reality, like the fact that she has never cooked Moroccan food, and her apartment is too small for the crowd that she invites, and the air conditioner isn't working, and it's August in the city. So that was really fun, and I have another question about that later. But it was interesting that you were able to, in that moment that you were sort of dropping me off and saying, no, this isn't happening yet, do something else that I really enjoyed. So I thought that was great. I don't know that I have a question, but it just reminded me. No, did you want to say anything about that? Or?
Oh, no, I was just going to say thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed that scene. I had fun writing that one.
Okay, good. Let's see. So the book is extremely honest, and I wish I had a great example to bolster what I'm about to say, but I came away from this feeling like you don't worry too much about political correctness when you write. And this is a subject that really interests me because lately, I feel like political correctness and triggering and stuff like that has started to inhibit authors and affect what they write. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this change.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because most of this book was written so long ago, and I feel like I've actually evolved a lot since then. You know, the book was written between 2011 and 2018,
okay,
mostly. So, but you know, I think as with a lot of people, I should say as with a lot of white people, I've kind of gone on my own. I've had my own evolution over the past decade of, you know, just political awareness and, awareness of my own privilege and awareness of where I do and don't kind of fit into the discourse around politics and identity. And so I think in one sense, this was like a book written by a different version of me. And the book I'm working on now is a creative nonfiction book that explores questions of identity a lot more directly. It's about my family history and how it intertwines with American history. And it's a lot about, you know, coming to terms with my own whiteness and things like that. So I am engaging with those things, but not in, you know, not in this book in a way that's very visible. But I think maybe what you're noticing when you say I don't seem concerned with political correctness, like I think, again, like I think just humor and an awareness of the absurd is something that runs through my writing and also through my life. And, no matter what I'm looking at, I think I can, or I try to have a sense of humor about it,
right.
you know, and to not be too self-serious about anything.
Right, right.
And so I think, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, against political correctness or anything like that. I think what people call political correctness is just, I think of that as just being respectful, you know.
Right.
But
I'm not actually calling you out and saying I found anything inappropriate at all in here. It's just like every once in a while your characters will say something wryly or, you know, with like a little bit of sarcasm, and I'm like, you know, it's just her. She's letting her characters be actual characters, and they're not necessarily so couched in safety all the time. So.
And I think that's partly what I'm saying about like
humor and
having a sense of humor, and also partly I think Thomas especially is not like, there's some ways in which, I don't know, I think probably the word toxic is overused these days, but there's definitely some ways in which he's a toxic man, and he knows that about himself and he struggles with it. And I think, you know, certainly like he is not me, I'm not any of these characters, but I'm interested in, I don't know. I was interested in his internal dilemmas and interested in sort of the dilemma of someone who, you know, really on the one hand respects women and has, you know, their best friend is a woman, and yet struggles with these objectifying impulses. You know, I'm interested in the question of what's going on in this person and why they are that way and how they deal with it. And I think it's not helpful to like pretend that that isn't happening. You know what I mean?
Right.
So to kind of look at it, as you say, wryly, I guess that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great.
But yeah, anyway, that was probably a way longer and more rambling answer.
No.
Than you expected.
No,
but
that's fine. It was good. I'm going to just interrupt us for a second and say to listeners, you are listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I am speaking with the author Amy Bonifons about her debut novel, The Regrets. If you're enjoying the show, please rate it on your podcast app, like it on Facebook, help spread the word. Okay, so Amy, some of the ideas that you present in the book, and we've already sort of covered some of this, but some of them are really strange. Like, they're original, but they're very strange. For example, Rachel has this great idea that daydreams can create reality, and she sort of lets this theory spin out, and at one point she explains, "I have fallen in love with my own daydreams," and she believes her daydreams live inside her body, but also go out into the world and return to her embodied as men, as she puts it. So when I think about my own work and, you know, how easy it is to start questioning yourself, think you're going in the wrong direction, you know, sabotaging ourselves as writers, I wonder if, how is it when you're working on something that people might see as strange, which I loved and I thought you pulled it off great. I mean, you've been compared to Haruki sorry, I'm saying I had a typo. Haruki Murakami.
He's my favorite author.
Fantastic.
So that gratifies me a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as you're working on something that's unusual, how do you keep from sabotaging yourself and saying, this is too weird, I need to back off from it? Or do you ever?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I have plenty of ways of sabotaging myself. I think in general, when I find something weird that I'm excited about, I see that as like, oh, I'm really onto something. Because what I like to read is weird stuff. You know, I don't like to read, you know, another version of the same book that I read last week or last year. I like to read something new. So I think that's something I actually get excited about, when I'm like, oh, this is really weird. I guess I should go with it. You know, I think, of course, you never know how someone's going to respond to what you're creating. And, you know, I have my own set of worries about that, but, I feel like I'm pretty good at embracing the weird, and like, when, you know, when I'm teaching, always encouraging my students to do that too.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I thought worked really well in the same, you know, subject, is that the narrative knows it's weird. And in a way, you know, in the way the narrative kind of points at its own weirdness and makes no apology, which kind of, allowed me as a reader to go like, oh, okay, well, as long as the book knows it's weird, then it's fine. So like,
yeah.
So one example is Thomas and Rachel decide that they have complementary weirdnesses. And, you know, it was just this moment when you're letting the reader know that this is okay and this is how it's supposed to be. I don't know if that's making any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I love that description. Okay. Thank you.
Now, you share some of your characters' dreams, and I loved them, and I was so glad you did. But I know some writing teachers and editors sometimes advise against writing dreams. So I wondered, what do you think of that, and is that risky?
Yeah, well, this is a good example of the kind of thing that I wonder about when I'm, you know, considering showing my writing to someone.
Right.
Because, yeah, there is this sort of, like, axiom that we're told in, you know, in writing classes, like, I think there's a phrase, like, describe a dream, lose a reader, something like that.
Oh, wow.
And I forget who told me that. But I am a person who's, like, super involved in my own dream life. I have really, really vivid dreams. They usually stay with me. And they're not, like, they don't tend to predict the future or anything like that, but I feel like they often resonate throughout my day or throughout my week in these kind of surprising ways.
Oh, wow.
And I think because that's such a big part of my own experience, it feels weird to me to not include my character's dreams. And I really like the space of the dream too, as a kind of, you know, sometimes it's kind of a distorted mirror of what's happening on the surface. Sometimes they actually receive some information in the dream. Like, I think Rachel has some dreams that actually give her some information about Thomas.
Right.
And sometimes they're really fun to write for me because I think they give me the chance to be, like, not exactly a poet, but, like, to write in a different register where it's all image and you don't have to make sense, you know? And so if you're just looking to kind of distill the emotional dynamic of something, a dream can do that. And I really love writers and artists who sort of harness the dream in their work. So Murakami's one, or like David Lynch, or you know, anybody associated with surrealism in any way. Like, I find that kind of work really interesting and powerful.
Okay. All right, great. Now, your last book was a story collection, and we already talked a little bit about it. One of the stories in there, The Wrong Heaven. I'm wondering what you're writing next. You said you were working on some creative nonfiction. So that's actually now we've got a third category because you've written stories and novel and now creative nonfiction. So if you can talk a little bit about how you experience each of those things.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, I think as with most young writers, I just wrote short stories for a really long time. And then had the idea for this novel and, you know, took a long time to realize it.
Right.
And I think as I sort of finished it, I was like, I cannot just sit down and write another novel. Like, it would be like, you know, getting up to run a marathon the day after you ran a marathon. So I was like, I need to do something different, you know? So that was part of the reason I was drawn to this creative nonfiction project. And then I'd also, this material had just been tugging at me for a while, and it felt like a way to explore questions that were on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that I think when I write fiction, it's very much like, you know, I sit down at my desk and I have to, like, get into the world of the story and get into the world of the characters. And some days that's very seamless and some days it just doesn't happen. And the project I'm working on now, it feels almost like there's no difference between the project and my life.
Oh, wow.
And that feels both really, on the one hand, it's exciting because I feel like I'm working through the questions that are obsessing me, like in real time on the page.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's some days I just sit down and I don't know where to begin because I'm like, this is about literally everything. And I don't have the constraint of, you know, embodying it in these two or three characters. And so, you know, where do I begin and how do I structure it? And what is it not about? Because it feels like it's about everything. And so I think that's the challenge I'm realizing that comes along with nonfiction. It's like you don't have to come up with the plot. You don't have to decide what happens,
yeah,
but you have to decide what to include and what to exclude, and why you're telling the reader what you're telling them. And that's a whole new challenge. But I think I needed a whole new challenge after hammering away at that one particular kind of challenge for years.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. What are you reading lately that you might recommend to listeners? Is there anything that comes to mind in particular?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of great nonfiction books I've read recently that recently came out, I'm reading Jen Chaplin's My Autobiography of Carson McCullers, which is great. I just read Carmen Maria Machado's In the Dream House. Yeah. Both of those were really cool, like, genre-bending nonfiction works that were inspiring to me for my current project. And then in terms of fiction, I just recently read this book of short stories, Skin Folk, by Nalo Hopkinson. I'm not sure I'm saying her first name right, but they're a little bit, but some of them are speculative, and some of them are sort of retelling of fairy and folk tales, both from Europe and from the Caribbean.
Oh, wow.
And I found those really cool and exciting. It almost made me want to, like, you know, get out a fairy tale and write my own version of it.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, those are always fun. I just have a couple more questions for you. So so in 2005, sure, you co-founded a website called 7x7. I mean, it's not a website, it's an online journal. And the about page on the website describes it as aiming to facilitate a new kind of interdisciplinary collaboration. Do you want to just talk a little bit about how this came about, what it is?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and then also how it happens. Like, are the artists given a prompt, or are they given anything to start with? So anyway, if you want to just go with that.
Yeah, sure.
Great.
Yeah, so it was actually in 2015 that we went live with it. But before that, Axel Wilhite, who's a painter friend, he actually did his MFA in fiction at NYU too, and then decided to pursue his painting practice rather than his writing practice. And so we started doing some collaborations together just for fun.
Right.
And we did them in sort of exquisite corpse style. Like, I would write a paragraph and then he would illustrate it and I would respond to his illustration. And, we did a few of those and we both found it really refreshing just to collaborate with someone and to kind of get out of our usual practice and do something different. And, at one point we had the idea that, oh, you know, we could actually invite other people to do this and we could publish the results and maybe that would be fun. And so, that's what 7x7 is. It's, basically we pair up a writer and a visual artist, and sometimes we pair them just randomly based on who, you know, who's available. And sometimes, you know, a pair will come to us and they know they want to work together. And, The rules are basically they're supposed to set aside 2 weeks and they decide who starts. So say the artist starts, they would create an image on the first day, and then on the second day the writer would respond to that. On the third day the artist would respond to that, and so on and so forth until you have 7 images and 7 pieces of text.
Okay.
And so it it creates a little, you know, a story or a little series of poems or whatever you want to call it. Some of them are harder to classify than that. Combining images and words, and they're very much the result of the process. And so they, you know, they turn out in all sorts of different ways, and it's really fun to see the way that different writers and artists respond to the challenge.
Yeah.
Although for me, I think even better than the products are, you know, the process that people report having. You know, oftentimes they're like, oh, this was something completely new for me. It helped me get out of a rut.
Oh, great.
You know, now I'm interested in collaborating more. And so, you know, I think I'm really interested in the ways in which we get sort of locked into our own creative practice and what can kind of shake us up and get us out of that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. And so the website's 7x7.la, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Or 7x7.
7x7.la. Yeah.
LA,
so
right.
we're always accepting submissions. If you know, if there's any writers or artists in the audience who want to play, you can email us info at 7x7.la. 7by7.la.
Okay. That's
great. And we'll set you up.
And at the end of the show, I always offer my listeners a writing prompt. And I was thinking this week I might send them to that website to sort of see if they get inspired by some of the visual stuff.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Yeah.
So, let's see. Okay. So I started to say this before, but I loved the side story of Samira in your book. She's a great character. And I feel like your secondary characters get treated as real full characters with actual stories that inform the larger narrative, even though they are subplots. So at one point you mentioned that Samira is determined to insist on her version of the world. That's your words.
Mm-hmm.
And Rachel and her friends like the idea of, quote, a world that is more responsive to our imagined visions of it. And this is all around this subplot with Samira, but the whole novel sort of intimates that there's more to reality than we can understand and that imagination is part of that. And I loved the way that you kind of tie these smaller stories with these other characters into sort of your larger presentation of narrative. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this and if you have any advice for other fiction writers about creating subplots and secondary characters that somehow, you know, are really organic to the larger work.
Yeah, great question. I'm thinking about that.
No, I know. I'm sorry. It's kind of a big question. I mean, when you did that with Samira, did you know you were going to come to that conclusion, or was that just something? Because I know you say you don't outline, so it must have been kind of an organic process.
Yeah. So I remember with that character in particular, I did have someone in mind who was sort of a model for her. And so I, you know, started writing that scene just thinking like, oh, what would so-and-so do? And then, of course, she evolved quickly into her own person, not a carbon copy of my friend. But, you know, there's that E.M. Forster thing about there being round characters and flat characters.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's useful advice for some people. I, at least in this book with the side characters, it was important to me that they feel round, even if we only see them for a few pages.
Right.
That we kind of intimate that there is a roundness there. And so, I think starting with like a real person as a germ is always helpful to me. And then just letting the character kind of tell me who they want to be. But it's interesting, you know, you point out that line at the end of that passage. That's something that I think just came out of the writing process. I had no idea that would come out.
Okay.
And so just thinking about like, what would Rachel think of this situation that her friend has concocted, and how would she, make sense of it and maybe judge it a little bit? And what does that say about her and her, you know, sort of her refusal to throw herself fully into experience sometimes in the way that her friend does? You know, I think our friends become foils for us in lots of ways. And some of our friendships are aspirational, and sometimes they're sort of like, oh God, well, she's really fun to have around, but thank God I'm not like her. Like, that sounds exhausting. So I think, you know, like, thinking of the characters of the secondary characters not only as like interesting beings in and of themselves, but for ways to clarify who the main character is in relationship and why the main character keeps certain people around them. I think, you know, that dynamic is really interesting to explore.
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me is, as you're speaking now, it strikes me that, of course, Rachel is going to respond to anything that she comes up against, you know, with the perspective of what's happening in her life right now. And so that kind
of
makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, listen, Amy, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Before you go, I'm wondering if you can share the best place for listeners to learn more about your work, if they would like to.
Yeah, sure. And thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Yeah.
My website is amybonifons.com. And I try to keep it updated with, you know, events and things like that. And so they can find everything they need there.
Okay, great. And I'm going to actually put a link to your website on the podcast site and a link to 7by7 as well. So that'll be
wonderful. Thank you so much.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I just aired a live interview with the author Amy Bonifons, whose new book is The Regrets, published by Little Brown. I want to just repeat what the Write the Book prompt is for this week, and that is have a look at the website for the journal that Amy co-founded, 7by7.la, and you'll find there some wonderful, very short flash pieces, or you can look at some of them as poetry pieces that are interspersed with related visuals that are done by visual artists. It's a really interesting collaborative journal, and I really had fun reading some of these and looking at them, but also maybe it would make a good prompt for the coming week. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're enjoying this show and are interested in sharing it with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, at writethebook.podbean.com, and everywhere that podcasts are as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week, everybody.